Hello, and welcome to another episode of What Makes You Click. I'm your host, Kelvin Bullock. And every once in a while, I'll have the opportunity to chat with an OG of the industry. I mean, somebody who's been in the game for 30 years plus. Today's guest is one such individual. He is an amazing portrait photographer who, whether you realize it or not, you have seen and loved his work. I mean, there's about a 98.9% chance that you have seen this man's work before and you have loved it. And if you haven't loved it, I don't know what's going on with you. Get your eyes checked because it is just that good. And even for me, I mean, I've enjoyed looking at his work since I was a kid, even before I was into photography or even knew who he was. I mean, the level of talent he has is just that great. And so without further ado, I want you guys to take a listen to hear what makes Mr. Andrew Eccles click. Andrew, hey, I appreciate you for being gracious with your time and having this conversation with me. I've been very excited to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, I'm really happy to be here. I'm flattered that you invited me, and I'm thrilled to meet you electronically and look forward to talking.
What I normally like to do is I start off the conversation by saying how I became aware of one's work. And honestly, I don't remember a time of not actually being aware of your work, because my introduction to you, before I even knew who you were, my introduction to your work were the images that I would always see of the Alvin Ailey dancers. For whatever reason, I don't know if it was just because in my household we just had magazines or publications that frequently either were promoting something that was happening with the productions, or whether it was just dance magazines around the house or what. I don't know what it was, but I was just always taken aback by these beautiful black bodies seemingly just frozen in time, the majesty of it all. I just couldn't get enough of it when I would see it. So that was how I first became aware of your work. And then in later years, when I actually got into photography, and I would come back to images of your work with Alvin Ailey and that dance studio, I would also then become aware of the different work that you would do with, you know, different celebrities and politicians. And I was just like enamored with how dynamic and how just not in a box your style and your work was. So I that was always something that was just very interesting to me.
Well, what a lovely introduction. That was really sweet. It's been nice talking to you. Thank you. I'm going to go now, because let's leave it at that. We'll end on a high note. Well, thanks. Thank you. I mean, for me, it essentially did start with dance, not with the Alvin Ailey company, but dancers were my first real subject matter, not necessarily by choice. I'll give you sort of a 2-minute sort of brief lead up to, you know, sort of how I started. And that's after going to art college in Toronto, Canada. I moved to New York. My parents got green cards when we were younger. We'll skip over that bit. So I was able to be in the United States. So I came to New York. A friend that I had known in art college somehow had worked his way into assisting Annie Leibovitz, which was amazing. And when I got in touch with him, and this is the really abridged version, when I got in touch with him, he invited me to come and be a second or third assistant there with her. Wow. Sort of on a freelance basis. We'll keep doing shortcuts, but he left. We won't say how or why, but he left. And she asked me to take over. And I became Annie's assistant for 3 years full time. And that was a long time ago. This was the early 80s. And it was a very small shop. It was just Annie and a studio manager and me. It wasn't the massive team of, you know, employees that she, I think, has around her now. So it's very intimate. And it was just as her contract with Rolling Stone had ended and her contract with Vanity Fair began. So it was a transitional time for her and her work too. But she had an affinity and love for dancers and photographing dancers. Once I began to do it myself, I completely understood why, and we'll circle back to that. But she did an assignment with a dance company, I think in Oakland, California. And at the end of my tenure of working with her, the manager of that company had moved on to a different dance company in New York, couldn't possibly afford Annie Leibovitz to photograph the dancers, and came to me and said, you know, are you out on your own now? Are you shooting yet? And I was starting to, and we ended up doing a photo shoot with that dance company. And that was really the first time anybody had officially asked me to take pictures, you know, a real assignment. And it was, you know, it was for no money. They paid the expenses, and it was an interesting company, and the dancers were beautiful. And by the end of the day, I had taken the names and numbers of all of the dancers in the company and asked if I could get in touch with them to do individual test shots with them and just little personal creative collaborations, which I went on to do. I spent pretty much whatever tiny bit of money I had saved up from assisting on those pictures. And that really became my first portfolio that I started shopping around. And some of the first assignments that I got were dance and or exercise pictures, because if I went to magazines, they would see fit, strong bodies and tights, and they thought exercise. So I ended up doing a lot of fitness pictures for women's magazines. And the fitness pictures led to beauty pictures. It's sort of the back of the book and the front of the book in magazines. And then eventually it led to an actress and a beauty story. And that started the celebrity thing rolling. But that sort of humble dance beginning remained, and I kept shooting dancers.
You know, Wow. Thank you for sharing that. There were so many different points in there that you made that I thought are very interesting, and we'll actually circle back to a few of them. But one of them that I did want to just briefly mention is, it's interesting how, you know, when you're starting out as a photographer and you pick the thing that you're like interested in shooting or the thing that you can build a portfolio on. And it's interesting how that thing, whatever that subject matter is, can dictate the type of work that you end up getting. So I think that's an interesting point, that the people that you would show your work to saw, you know, bodies and fitness and said, oh, well, he'd be great for this, because they hire off of what they see. So I always find that like interesting that, you know, earlier in my career, I didn't necessarily consider that. I was just trying to shoot everything, and then it's harder for them to even pick what it is that you do. So it's very, I like hearing those type of origin stories. But speaking of origin, something else that I like to do on this show is talk even a little bit more about the origins of yourself going all the way back to your childhood, because I even saw on a few different articles and even on your bio on your website that you were born in England, but you were raised in Toronto and Hawaii. So let's back up to that. How was it that you were born in London, but you're Canadian?
My father was British. And he moved to Canada when he was probably in his mid-20s. My mother was Canadian, living in Montreal. They met and married and ended up living, I think they lived in Vancouver for a while, and then they ended up back in Toronto. So now this is just sort of funny, because it's something that I never really got a straight answer from my mother about. But they went to visit my father's parents in England when she was 8.5 months pregnant. So, I mean, I don't even think that would be allowed in this day and age. I don't think your doctor or an airline, a responsible airline, would allow an eight-month pregnant person on a plane. But so I asked my mother, I said, so you and dad intentionally wanted to have me born in England so I would be British, a British citizen? And she was sort of like, well, no, dear. You know, your father just didn't really like to change his vacation plans. And like, but the math was simple. You were 8.5 months pregnant and you were going to be there for a month and a half. So it was what it was. And I was born there. And so because I was born there, I became a British citizen by birth. But I was taken, as soon as I was old enough, I was taken right back to Toronto and grew up in Toronto. My father did a thing that some people do when I was 12, and that's they go on vacation and they mistakenly think that they have found the place they belong and should be for the rest of time. So we went on a vacation to Hawaii. And I think after a couple of Mai Tais, he and my mother said, let's move here. You know, most people sober up and go home and take another vacation. My parents bought a house and got us ready to move. So that there's the green card. That's how I got a resident status in the States back when I was very, very young. My father applied and was granted resident cards for all of us. And once you get one, unless you do something terribly wrong, you don't lose it. You get to keep it. So we moved to Hawaii, which, you know, it was sort of spun as exciting at the time. But when I look back on it, it really uprooted us from our lives. My sister and I were sort of, you know, developing. And ironically, my sister was a ballet dancer. She went to the National Ballet School of Canada in Toronto. And I was a budding hockey player that was doing quite well for somebody my age and was being groomed to kind of go further in that. And, oh, wow. And we were just yanked, just pulled up and yanked and dropped in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in Hawaii. And so as exciting as it was and culturally valuable when I look back on it, it was also pretty disruptive for young kids. Ended up defining my sister's life more than mine, I think, because, you know, she married young, somebody from there, had kids fairly young. So it really had a profound effect on her life. For me, I went to school for a couple of years. Full disclosure, I was asked not to return after two because I started getting into a bit of trouble. And then I went back to Canada to a boarding school there and ended up in art college back in Toronto. So I sort of kind of went, you know, full circle quite quickly. My budding hockey career was destroyed, but that's okay. But I ended up back in Toronto for art college. So that was the sort of weird upbringing, but it's left me with some sort of citizen options, you know, and for work, that's not bad. I have a Canadian passport, which is helpful for the work, you know, a lot of the entertainment work that I do up there. I have resident status here and I'm still considered British and will be because of being born there so I can work there if I want as well.
I totally understand what you mean when you say that whole uprooting and changing like your life all the way around. Now, I was an Army brat, so it was a little bit different in that I got to get used to being uprooted. That was kind of like like we're out of there. And I can totally see that being disruptive. And you mentioned that, you know, hockey was really your thing. But did you have any creative pursuits that you felt like you were drawn to as a child?
Well, yeah. And you know, you'll laugh because probably every photographer that you've interviewed has exactly the same story. I, for a while, thought mine was unique. I thought, you know, well, my father gave me a camera when I was young. Every photographer's father apparently gave them a camera. I've now read it in virtually everybody's bio I've ever read. But my father did give me a Sirius 35 millimeter camera when I was pretty young, when I was that, you know, 11-year-old or 10 or 11-year-old. I think what might have been unique about my experience with that, it might have been the same for others, but my dad gave me some rolls of black and white film and kind of let me have at it with this camera. And when I went out and, you know, and funnily enough, first thing I did was went and took pictures of my friends playing hockey. But then I started sort of setting up things in my bedroom and kind of composing things. But what was possibly unique is my father would send the film to a relatively professional lab in Toronto and they would send back black and white contact sheets. And then my dad gave me a grease pencil and he said, if you want to crop them and sort of redesign what you want with this pencil, we'll get prints made. So at a very young age, I was kind of doing this relatively sophisticated and I'm sure very expensive. I mean, in fairness to him, he never said like, you can do three of these. I just went hog wild and was cropping all the pictures and he sent them off to the lab and all these prints came back cropped to my specifications. And I sort of was exposed to the process from loading the camera with film all the way to getting a cropped and somewhat art directed print back as it were. So that was pretty young. And then by the time I was 14 and living in Hawaii, you know, I'd take sort of what I thought were kind of creative pictures of like my sister and friends and stuff. I was kind of getting inspired by album cover photography at that time. There was a lot of really cool photography going on album covers like Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. And are we allowed to mention names and things?
Yes.
Houses of the Holy, Led Zeppelin. That was, I remember like when I first started buying record albums, I was like, wow, it was so cool and weird. And I couldn't really tell, is that really real or is that daytime or nighttime or, you know, and all of that was just things that I later learned are photographic techniques and some of it post-production. But anyway, so that was kind of the creative stuff did start relatively young. And I also sort of was a composition junkie from the get-go. I would always, I remember this well. I remember my mother would put a bunch of stuff out. There'd be things on the coffee table and I would sit there and slide them and push them and kind of, you know, bear with me. It was the 70s. So, you know, the ashtray beside the Life magazine and my mom's pack of cigarettes or whatever. And I would sort of compose everything all the time. I was always moving things into compositions that felt better. And you know, I think to this day, the way I see is has always been highly organized that way.
It sounds like the perfect melding of creativity and perfectionism. Do you feel like you have always had that kind of perfectionist spirit, or is that something that you learned along the way?
Well, yeah, and I'll say it's sort of been good and bad, both, you know. It's the upside is photography is essentially a fairly precise and scientific medium. But creativity, no matter what the medium, should be free and somewhat unrestricted, perhaps. Not should be, can be, maybe feels right when it is. But I think, you know, my mother was straight up OCD. I mean, I can say it, you know, bless her, God rest her soul. She's no longer with us, but she would be proud of that. I mean, she ran a perfect household. Everything, it almost looked like nobody lived there. I mean, everything was so sort of precise and so clean. And that all sort of rubbed off. And was something that sort of defined the way that I took pictures, but also held me back. I remember one of the very first jobs that I shot, big ones, really, really big ones early in my career, was with a very, very famous Japanese art director named Eiko Ishioka. And there was a lot of setup and it was, you know, there was plexiglass platforms and a swimming pool and planks to get models out and electricity in your water and danger and insurance. And it was big. It was a big production. And sort of all of the setup kind of came to releasing the shutter that very first time. And back then we would shoot Polaroids. We would have a Polaroid back on the camera. It wasn't digital, and we would shoot a Polaroid, which showed us exactly what the camera saw. We'd pull it, and we'd all wait patiently, stand around waiting. And I peeled open the Polaroid, and somebody handed it to Eiko. She's really just such a big deal, huge art director. And, you know, she didn't speak very much English, but in broken English, she said, "Oh, Andrew pictures so safety."
Wow.
And I have never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that. I mean, we're talking 30 some odd years later, and it's that her voice still rings in my head. Andrew's picture is so safety. And it wasn't a compliment at the moment. It was a concern on her part that, yes, it was technically true and good, and everything was in the right place, and it was all lit perfectly. But I now, looking back on it, know what she meant. And we ended up doing a couple of things that I think made it, you know, less safe. But it was pretty safe. It was a pretty safe picture and pretty safe campaign. But I was, you know, I was in the first couple of years of my career and everything I did was pretty safe. I didn't feel like I could take any risks.
This is interesting to me. These are the conversations that I like having, because not that it was a failure, but in your mind, it sticks out as one of those moments where you're like, damn, like, oh, like heart rich, like my heart dropped when you said it. And it's interesting because for me, you have a moment like that, and then you got like one or two options, or I mean, you got multiple options, but you can either like, you know, try to adjust and do better, or you can just in your mind, like completely give up and be like, well, damn, I guess this is not going to go well. So like, how do you readjust? And how did, like, when you heard that feedback, you just shared some of the first thoughts that you had, but how did you make it through that shoot ultimately?
Well, I gotta tell you, it was really hard because obviously the first thing you want to hear is, oh, that's amazing. Or that's so great. Better than I'd imagine. You know, those are all, those are all the things that our fragile egos are hoping for.
So true.
You know, I used to say that first Polaroid could make or break the way the rest of the day went. And I would tend to shoot five or six very quickly. And my assistant would sort of put them in front of me and I'd be like, that one and that one. And we had a way of trimming them and putting them in these little fold mat frames. And so sort of gild the lily, as it were, before I would show them around. But you hand that to the celebrity that you're photographing. If they love it, great. If they don't, you know, actually I actually have a funny story about that, which I can get to in a minute. But that day was challenging because I didn't have the experience to get out from under the insecurity that sort of came washing over me at that moment. Mm. The feeling that I had disappointed her. Now, in retrospect, it was a very successful campaign. The client was thrilled. They hired me back to do that. It was for a Japanese coat company called Sanyo Coats. And I did the campaign for 3 years. And that was having followed Annie Leibovitz and Steven Meisel and a couple of other huge photographers. And I was nothing, but I was a useful tool for Eiko's vision. And I think her concern was that it was just too safe. There wasn't anything courageous or dangerous. So that, not just that day, we got through the day. I mean, one thing to shake it up, I remember at one point, I didn't tell really all the people in the room, but we were in the swimming pool and everybody was worried about the electricity. And I didn't really think this far in advance, but I said quietly to the model, I said, put your hands out, you know, like this and scream. And nobody else knew it was coming, and she did. And of course, everybody came running and thinking that somebody had been electrocuted. But it shook things up, and actually, it ended up being the picture. It was the model was screaming, so that was less safe, I guess. And I think Eiko was was pleased. But it's taken years to crawl out from under that one piece of criticism. Eiko's no longer with us, but her voice still rings in my head often.
In the beginning, it sounds like a bit of a curse, but then at the same time, it was a gift because it did shape how you moved forward after that, to where it was like, okay, that happened. And now that I know that I can live through an experience like that and get, you know, and get hired again, like, I think that's a testament to, you know, your will to survive, but then to also be able to adjust when need be. And, you know, I think that's one of the marks of people who are successful at anything in any, you know, pursuit.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
just
go ahead.
One thing, just because I know it's probably uncomfortable for interviewers to have the tables turned, but I, you know, read on your bio, and I don't know whether it was you describing it or somebody else that said this about your work, that it was very clean.
Uh-oh.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody said that very similar thing about my work that sort of lived in my bio for years, that it was classical. What did they say? They said, technically perfect, classically composed something. And I sort of lived by that credo, very crisp and very clean. And I remember early in my career taking my portfolio to a now no longer magazine called Sassy Magazine. It was sort of a competitor of 17 Magazine. I don't remember the art director's name. And even if I did, I wouldn't say it. And I don't know where he is or if he's still working, but I will never forget what he said. And this was also very, very long ago. He looked through my portfolio and I remember he leant back and he really did that thing. He put his feet up on the desk.
Oh, no.
He said, "Mr. Eccles, your work is very crisp and very clean." And he enunciated everything.
Oh, no.
"Here at Sassy, we don't do very crisp and very clean." And at that point, I knew the interview was over, but he kind of expounded on how inappropriate my crisp and clean style was for the magazine. And, you know, off you go and you sort of just try to pick up where you left off and go to the next magazine and hope that they want crisp and clean. But what did you sort of give yourself the moniker of clean, or was that given to you?
It was given to me as well. And it's funny at this point, and it's interesting that we're having this conversation now, you know, the pandemic forced me to stop like everything that I was doing for a period of time. And there was a time where I was even asking the question, am I going to continue? Am I going to be a photographer after this? Like, where is my life headed with this thing? And it also made me take a look at the work that I've been creating. And I'm actually still in this to the point where next month I'm not doing any work in the month of August. And my wife and I are actually going to go to St. Lucia and kind of unwind. But the question remains, where do I want to go next? Like, I feel like I am tired of the aesthetic that I've created and people kind of know me by, and it's you know, okay, you know, nice, good looking people, clean images, yes, but where's more of the story? And I find myself trying to figure that out, and so I feel like I'm going to take this month off and really kind of, and I think you can actually relate to this, because I heard you talking about this at a certain point in your career. You felt like you had, you know, you knew what you were doing, and you kind of got a little lazy to the point where you didn't feel like you were progressing your work any further. And I kind of feel like I'm at a point where I don't know everything at all. Like, I don't know everything, and I've got a lot more to learn, but I did get complacent in the things that I was doing. And so now I've been taking this as an opportunity to kind of shake it up and figure out what I want to do next. But I know that you had that same situation as well. So how did you find your way out of that box that you had built for yourself?
Well, I mean, first of all, good for you that you're doing that. I think, you know, I reveal this with a little bit of shame, but I got tired. You know, I got really tired. I was very, very fortunate that my career went very well for many years. And when you're sort of caught up in it, and you know, there's assignment after assignment on the board, and it's great. I mean, that's just, it's so great. It's great to be wanted, it's great to be needed. It's great to be paid. It's exciting. You're meeting exciting people and you're traveling. But it doesn't matter how good certain things are. You know, lots of actors struggle with, their lives are magnificent and exciting, but they're exhausted because it's this kind of continuum. And, you know, I mean, the simple term is burnout. I got kind of burnt out. And I was shooting a lot of things where I felt it was more sort of quantity versus quality that I was being asked to produce. My creative input wasn't really being sought out as much as my ability to execute well, you know, get the people could count on me to get a lot shot in short periods of time, tackle huge complicated setups, you know. And after a while, you're kind of producing, you know, I started taking what I jokingly say, but I just started taking the same picture over and over again. And maybe you heard, I may have said it before, and I'm sorry if it's redundant, but I remember an assistant that I had not worked with came up to the monitor and he was like, "Wow, that's great. That's just great." And I smiled and I said, "You know, good. I'm glad you," I said, "I know that picture. I've done that picture over and over and over. I knew the little technical things that made it work and that made it look good, but I just know that picture. It wasn't something new." So, you know, I made I sort of made a paradigm shift as well. I also started looking around. I sort of was caught. I was caught up in my own, I'm not afraid to say it, ego, because ego enters into this, you know, and it's not a healthy place to be. And I got out of my own head, and I got back into appreciating where the industry was going, and new eyes and new vision. And because I didn't fully embrace the transition from film to digital for quite some time. When we shot film, and I was one of those shooters that shot medium format transparency film, so it was locked in. It had to be right. It had to be, you know, technically perfect and classically composed. I mean, you were handing over final art. It was a non-malleable piece of material that you were sending a client. Digital, you have a half-baked cake there. Not even. I mean, you really just have the ingredients, sort of. And I was making my pictures. I think it took me a while to get my pictures digitally to look like they did on film, which was great. But a lot of other photographers that were shooting digitally were taking them to some new places that I wasn't taking mine. The term that I use is I wasn't fully realizing what they could be. So if I was taking a picture, it would almost feel like I would take it to a 7, whereas I could try taking it to maybe an 8.5 or a 9, or whoa, you know, let's dial it all the way up to a 10. Let's see how much contrast makes sense. Now, that having said that, not to turn into some sort of, you know, post-production maniac where I completely lose any sense of what I've been doing all along. I've always tried to maintain that, but I think there was a moment there where I was eclipsed by a lot of photographers that, you know, experienced and less experienced, that were taking their images further than I would. I was being very safe. I was being very safety with my digital image. And then I became a little less safety, and I feel like I caught back up again and started to really enjoy it again, because like, oh wow, look how exciting that can look. And things started to look new again.
I hear this story and from different photographers at different points in their careers. And I'd read somewhere that Albert Watson was talking about how, you know, when he first started out, he was very energetic and spontaneous. But as he continued to like really understand what photography was technically, he started to fine tune the technicalities. And then he got bored with his work because it wasn't as spontaneous. And then he figured out how to kind of like, you know, be both when it was possible. So I think it's always interesting to kind of hear the different ways that we kind of face that same dilemma and how we either overcome it or succumb to it. And it sounds like you've definitely overcome it. Not only sounds like, it looks like, just from your body of work.
One thing that's interesting, and I just, if we can stay on this point for just a moment.
Sure, please.
It might be helpful to some of your listeners too, is that I learned something the other day that I found fascinating. And that we're sort of culturally obsessed with the idea that things need to be binary. They're either this or that.
True, true.
And somebody shared this piece of wisdom with me the other day. They said, what's the opposite of a true statement? And I said, a false statement. And they said, yeah. And they said, what's the opposite of a profound truth? And I said, I don't know. He said, another profound truth, which I thought was really interesting. Yeah, think about that one for a minute, Calvin. I think some scientist or in Norway, I think that's his quote. But at any rate, the idea that two things can be true, more than one thing can be true at the same time. So there, you can become dissatisfied, like perhaps Albert Watson was, with your work being too contrived or too composed or dull. Right. But that doesn't mean that you have to run in the other direction and pick up a 35 millimeter camera and run around like nuts, not looking through it and shooting, you know, catch as catch can. First of all, there are many places in between those two, but they can also both exist. And what I've ended up finding, what I've been doing on shoots in the last handful of years, is I still think there's a place for a beautifully composed, beautifully lit image. I think photography should look special. I completely understand the whole Instagram lifestyle. Totally get it. Makes perfect sense. But I still like photographs to feel special, not like a snapshot per se. So, but that's not for everybody. So what I tend to do is have two cameras on set now, where I'll have a medium format camera and take a really composed, technically sound image. And then I'll grab a 35 millimeter camera and put it on, you know, continuous focus and move around and let people talk and talk at them and have them talk to other people and end up with both. And that sort of seems to satisfy the needs of people that feel, oh yeah, that's boring. That's too composed. That's too still. So, but you can have both, and you don't have to have one or the other. You don't have to pick, is really what that sort of setup was about.
I like that perspective, and you're so right. Things are, I mean, just, and a part of it is because of social media and the way that we use it, that things are so binary, and we see the division in the world that we see now, because of the way that we kind of look at these things. But you've made mention a couple of different times in regards to the transition from film to digital and how it took you some time to do that. And I read a blog post that you wrote for Scott Kelby's blog 10 years ago. And you, in this post, it was, first of all, very well written. I feel like you should be writing books as well, because your voice, I can hear it, and your personality comes through on your through the words that you use. So anyway, very well written. As I'm reading this, I'm starting to understand that you aren't really a fan, or weren't really a fan back then, and I could see it being actually worse now, but of digital in a few different ways. Like, for instance, people being on their phones while on set can be a distraction, but also shooting tethered to where everybody can see the images that you're making in real time, versus a situation like you said, well, back in the day, you'd have those Polaroid backs to, and then you would basically call through those, and you curated the Polaroids to show the creative directors. Now you have to basically take the shot and everybody can see it on the monitor. And in that piece that you wrote, you were kind of talking about how that can be detrimental to the creative process and the working with you and the flow with the subject. How do you feel now, especially in this age of COVID? And I don't know if you, I'm sure you have, but nowadays when you're doing a COVID shoot and you've got the PR team and the creative director and whoever else, they're in New York, they're in LA, but they're all on a Zoom call and they're watching it live. And, you know, they're kind of giving they're typing notes in the chat and they're giving their say on what they think it should be. What are your thoughts on the evolution of this thing? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? Is it the same? What are your thoughts?
Wow. There's a lot to unpack.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, in a good way. First of all, I'm really tickled and thrilled that you found that Scott Kelby blog, because funnily enough, he wanted me to talk about lighting. And I was feeling all these feelings about the transition. And it wasn't that I didn't want to talk about lighting. I just thought that this was far more important to talk about because it was happening all around us. And so I kind of used Scott's blog as a rant. I mean, it was, I hope that it was a measured rant, but there's no doubt that apart from the technical, is film better than digital? I think that's moot at this point. I think you can say there's advantages to both. They're both beautiful. And there are no doubt there are production advantages to what digital did was it changed the process by how we take pictures. And those two things were happening at the same time. Smartphones, which followed Blackberries and things like that, that was happening at the same time. So you were getting sort of a kind of an odd dual technological assault of change. And I remember the shoot, and I don't think she would mind my mention. I was photographing Marcia Cross from The Desperate Housewives, and nobody was saying anything in the room. And I looked over my shoulder and everybody was on their things. They were all scrolling through other, so they were somewhere else. Nobody was in the room. Their minds were all out there elsewhere. And that was very strange to me that nobody was present, that this was the moment that I thought was of their greatest concern, this magazine cover that we were shooting. So that was weird, but simultaneously this thing got rolled into the room, this big monitor where in a nanosecond, everyone in the room could see every picture you took, good or bad. There was no, the hit and miss was taken away, but more than that, what was taken away was the idea that a photographer and his, we were thought of as magicians of a kind. There was something that was, we were graced with the ability to connect with the subject and deliver this photographic result that was a bit like a Christmas present that you get to open tomorrow, because you don't really know. You kind of get a hint, but you never really know. You'd leave the studio and you get on the plane and you'd look at the Polaroids and hoping you got that one, but you don't really know. It might be better, might be worse when you see the film the next day, but you were left alone. Everything was set up, and then we're going to let the photographer and the subject, with some input here and there, decide what's the way to do this. And that got blown out of the water with the monitor. Everybody started chiming in and saying, do this, do that, or no, that's not right, because they hadn't learned. They might not have the skill set. And also, that would be like a bunch of people standing behind Martin Scorsese while he's directing film saying, oh, wait, no, say that differently, because that didn't sound right. And it just sort of, and again, this is an ego. This isn't, I'm the director and I don't want that. It's a collaborative thing. We've all been invited to create this thing. But as soon as it got diffused by that element, it just changed things. They're different. They're different now. And when I shoot sort of smaller personal projects and it's just me and a 35 millimeter camera and I'm not shooting to some kind of laptop or computer, it's interesting. It reminds me, oh yeah, we're really connected here, because a lot of shoots, the photographer can't connect. And then just to wrap up with how much that was sort of amplified by the COVID experience. Yeah. I mean, I did a shoot up in Vancouver a month ago or so I was surrounded by computers and iPads and all these people sitting at their desks in LA while I was in Vancouver shooting something. They're not only watching every frame, there's cameras on me. It's surreal. But I will tell you, there was one little technical advantage, in that there was a short delay on when the pictures would come up for them, which left them fairly tongue-tied. They didn't really have a chance for input until we took a natural break. But messages were being sort of delivered to me. It was respectful and it ended up working well. It's just different now. It's just different.
The very first COVID shoot that I had, where everybody was on Zoom and, they've got the cameras on me and they got the camera on the set. My Digitech is zoomed in and it's sharing a screen. And I remember thinking, maybe like 15 minutes into the actual shoot, I was like, man, is it over yet? Like, are we almost done? Because we get so used to being able to do things in a certain way. And then when something comes along like COVID and it totally changes like everything, our worlds are just like totally blown apart. And this industry was no different. So when it happened and there weren't systems put into place, where now when I do one of these shoots, there's like a designated one or two people who can actually like give input. And there's like systems in place that kind of help from like making the shoot take longer, because everybody felt like they needed to either type something or say something. But during that first shoot, I couldn't connect at all with the subject. And I walked away feeling like, damn, like that, I could pass her on the street and she wouldn't even like speak to me or know who I was. Not because I had a mask on, but because we didn't have any, there was nothing. And of course, that's going to happen from time to time. I mean, there's times where you just got to bang them out and try to get what you can while they're there. But, you know, I am a firm believer in that that connection is what makes it like special for me. And yeah, I'm here to do a job and get paid for it. But if I can have that connection, you know, I'm all about it.
You're absolutely right. That is the process. I remember hearing somebody discussing, you know, some sort of an essayist discussing portrait photography, and they said something, paraphrasing, but the most successful portrait photography is where the camera acts as an equals symbol between the subject and the photographer. And it's this symbiotic two-way communication. And that, I think that natural flow is sometimes interrupted by too much interference, right? Interference. It's like you and I talking, and if we, you know, if our microphones are working, your headphones, and there's very little, we have a good connection, there's very little interference. You and I are complete. Could you imagine if somebody kept, you know, popping into the room that you're in or opening this door here? And after a while, we wouldn't feel connected at all. This is the way it should feel. I think there's photographers that do that in a really profoundly successful way. I think Platon is one of them. I think the way that he works, the way that he still shoots film, I think it's sweet because his film immediately goes into the digital process and is scanned and becomes a digital piece of art. But what I love about what he does is he kept the process. Mm-hmm. He kept the process the same. And he's in that space he creates under his lights and in the midst of the foam core and him and the subject. And it's very, very personal. And, you know, for the most part, a lot of our assignments don't necessarily require that or wouldn't necessarily be benefited by it. But to your point about leaving a photo shoot feeling like you didn't really connect with the subject at all, I feel the same way sometimes. I feel as though the subject kind of comes in and they look around like, who's directing? Where's it coming from? There's voices over there. Oh, well, here's one person. And then I'm here. But I've had those situations where literally at the same time, as I say, sit down, somebody says, stand up, or, you know, so there's this kind of cross. It's almost counterproductive. And that was what I ranted about in that Scott Kelby blog, was the loss of a very magical process that was getting chipped away at and homogenized to the point where a photographer can be demoted to a glorified button pusher, depending on the outlet and the assignment. But I know the ones that go best, and I sense that you have a very, very good ability to connect with your subjects, is when the subject is going to give you the most, when they feel connected, they feel safe. They're people. They want to feel connected and heard and understood, and that sense of belonging. They don't want to be abandoned out there in a big dark space with a bunch of voices coming out from behind the lights. They want, you know, the connection.
And as you say that, it makes me think again about the work that you do with the dancers, not even just Alvin Ailey, but just all the dancers that you work with. And I've experienced this in the past where dancers are amazing people to work with because they are very collaborative, and they you know, they know the importance of how to shape themselves in a way that's going to look good with the lighting. And, you know, it's always a fun experience. And it makes me think about, because this is something that I wanted to ask. You have been working with Alvin Ailey for the 20, 30 years almost. And I guess for me, when I get a client and I'm like, you know, who knows how long this will last? They might like my style for some time and then they'll bring somebody else in, just like I replaced the guy who came before. So my question is, how do you cultivate a relationship in such a way that it lasts for that long? Because I sense that there had to be growth on both sides and evolution on both sides. But how did you maintain that?
Well, this is a timely question in many ways. So the initial contact came through something more divine than a general just sort of portfolio drop-off. I was assigned to photograph Alvin. I think if you sort of poked around my website and whatnot, you probably came across me maybe talking about that. And then it was in 1989, I was assigned to photograph him before I even really knew who he was or who the dance company was. I knew dance. I understood dance. I'd already had that experience that I told you about with that dance company. I loved and respected dance, but I knew of the Alvin Ailey Dance Company, but I was assigned to photograph him, the man. And I was terribly, terribly nervous. And he was a formidable guy. He came in, we didn't talk. He choreographed the whole thing. I didn't know what he was doing. I just shot as quickly as I could. He looked kind of mean and scary, frankly. So I was intimidated, but he sat down and he just started moving and composing himself through his hands. And I thought, I don't know what's happening, but I know I just better keep shooting. Just film, shoot, kept putting more backs on my camera and shooting. And then he laughed and he left. And he sadly passed away 3 months to the day of that photo shoot. Now, some time passed, so it wasn't like I photographed him and he ran to his, you know, art director and said, get that guy to photo that. None of that happened. But later, a few years down the road, I was shooting more dancers for a magazine called Dance Inc. and a few other dance publications. I was doing quite a lot of dance stuff. My work was seen by, well, somebody. Well, I was assigned to photograph Judith Jamison from Ailey, who was the creative director that took over after Alvin passed. And I was assigned to photograph her. She liked the pictures I took of her very much. The experience of photographing her was very similar, except less intimidating because we got along very well. And she recommended that I come in and take some pictures of their dancers. But it was not a lock. I did pictures 1 year, and then they tried somebody else, and Nanny did them 1 year, and then some other photographers. Then I came back, but I kept being sort of put in the mix. And the pictures that I were taking seemed to land in some sort of iconic way. They were very representative of the company. They seemed to help define the brand that they were hoping to put out there. And it just became something that was a regular deal. It was more of a handshake than anything else. They just stopped trying other photographers. Also, the dancers preferred working with me, apparently, than some of the other photographers that were brought in, because I also developed a rapport and a relationship with them. And so it went for a very, very long time. We morphed and grew, and we did very good pictures. We did some that were less interesting. We had to sometimes also think, what are we doing? What's everybody else doing? Let's make sure we stay current. Sometimes that was something that we were doing together. Sometimes it was something I was pushing for. But either way, we made strides and we made progress and did a lot of wonderful work together. This COVID pause and what's going on in culturally in the country, in the arts, in our society, has given the company an opportunity to rethink their direction. They were extremely gracious in calling me not that long ago to explain that they were going to try something new going forward. I embrace that. I'm not at liberty to reveal what direction they're going. I not only approve, I think it's a very commendable and an extremely wise and timely choice. I'm excited to see what they do together and where they take it, but I am immensely proud and thankful to have carried whatever symbolic baton Alvin passed me back that day in 1989 to now here in 2021. The work that I collaborated on with Ailey, I feel, has defined my career and been the pictures that I'm proudest of having taken this whole time.
Wow. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And I can totally see why you would feel that way about the work. I mean, that's how I even, like I said from the beginning, that's how I even became aware of your work. And I just got to say, you know, as a Black person, I truly appreciate the way that you captured us. Like I said, just beautiful Black bodies in motion is what kind of comes to my mind when I think about that work that you created. And this is kind of, I'll probably will cut this part out, but I'm curious, the shooting film back then, shooting film and the way that they kind of made film, it wasn't always it didn't always make our skin look the greatest. So how did you even work around that issue? Or was there like, what, does that make sense? Does my question make sense to you? I don't know.
No, it makes perfect sense. And it's something that I think was never sort of handled or discussed very well or very delicately for many, many years. I'd be shooting a group shot and there'd be an African-American actor and an art director would, you know, whisper, you know, make sure there's enough light on, you know, and as though I could sort of magically like just sort of wave a wand and this person would be under some sort of like, that person's got different skin than that person. That person's lighter and I'm not going to be able to necessarily remove that much light, but you know, we would work the way we would, not yeah. that there was this kind of person or that kind of person. If somebody was wearing something white or somebody was wearing something black, we would have to take into consideration detail
yep.
and don't blow out the highlights and don't lose all the shadows. So you would make adjustments. Back in the film era, I really learned through Annie, through a lot of testing, things that worked, things that didn't. Some skin tones were more challenging. I remember she did a photo shoot. I wasn't assisting, but I remember looking at the film on the light table. She photographed Miles Davis, and I think she had had some real challenges that the film had come back a little too dark, and his skin was so dark. I can appreciate that there were some challenges there, and exposure differences do have to take place. Certain films were better at it, to your point. Some films lent magenta, so skin would be redder. Others would be greener. I won't say which ones were which. And they all needed to be tested and thought through. But my essential feeling always was I'm creating a realistic representation of what is before me. And only a certain amount of adjustment. If my color and my light is true, then I should be recording what is before the camera properly. And there shouldn't be that much of a massive kind of adjustment. So I do remember having conversations with Judith and the creatives at Ailey that they seem to settle upon the way that I shot, my style and my color, the way I captured Black skin, that it was warm, that it was inviting. Warm and inviting was our sort of, that was sort of the mandate, I guess, or the way that the company was wanting to present itself. That's come in, one and all. It's welcoming, it's warm. These are beautiful. There's beautiful warm skin under gorgeous lighting. And that worked until there was sort of a paradigm shift in, I think, our visual palette out there in the world of advertising shifted out of those tones into other tones. And for whatever reason, that tonality seemed a little dated or could look or appear less modern. So that's when we started exploring ways that we might be able to make sure that we were up to speed and looking current. Ailey, the choreography was growing. They were bringing in really interesting dancers and works and music that they were growing. The company was growing. That they were still performing Revelations and all of their classics from the inception of the Ailey Company, but they were also doing a lot of really exciting new modern stuff. So that's an opportunity to gain a new audience to bring them in. I think the direction that they're going to go in is going to likely broaden that I hope, even more. And if for any reason things don't work out, I'm still here and I would come back in a heartbeat.
Of course.
Collaborate with them in any which way they would ever want. But I just want to make it perfectly clear that I could not be more excited for them. And it also allows me an opportunity to perhaps go and work with some other dance companies. I haven't even approached another dance company for all these years, not because I was under contract, just because I felt connected and committed to them. And also when you photographed a company like that, they're great. Every time they would jump in front of my camera, it felt like pure perfection. And I thought, well, I don't even know where else to go to get that feeling. But having said that, there's all sorts of fascinating dancers and companies and different genres of dance all over the world. And I'm now thinking, oh, wow, this could be really exciting. If somebody else is interested in maybe collaborating, I could take a new direction with them somewhere. I'm not going to necessarily bring what I was doing for Ailey other than the experience, because then I'll shut up, is the one thing that I found watching other people who don't shoot dance very much, that I had the glorious honor of having had so much practice, that capturing that nanosecond of when the right thing is happening, because it is a fraction of a second, the difference between a hand being there or a foot being there. And that, I thankfully have done it enough that it's second nature. So I can bring that with me wherever I go. But I would be very excited and intrigued to perhaps work with an entirely different ballet or something different.
Wow. So we've made it pretty far. And I've got one last question for you. And again, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I mean, you're dropping very, very good points. And I love your storytelling. I can tell that whoever is in front of your camera is probably easily kind of led into the process, because from the moment we hopped on and you're smiling, I'm like, okay, I like this guy. I can tell already. But anyway, I digress. The last question. If you were to be graduating from the College of the Arts today and entering out into this digital world, do you think that you would do some of the same things that you did back then, as far as, you know, going the assisting route and then kind of, and of course you did get extremely lucky with landing that, you know, the gig with Annie, and I saw you had even did some assisting for Robert Mapplethorpe and Steven Meisel. So like you've had some pretty amazing opportunities, but how would you, I guess, proceed graduating in the 21st century?
Well, I think the question is, if I knew then what I know now, there are some things that I don't think I would do differently. There's a handful of things that I definitely would do differently. And maybe this is the part that hopefully can help somebody who's listening. I can't imagine doing what I do or what many of us do without having assisted. I get the self-taught idea, but I can't imagine what my career would look like if I had not had that hands-on, really seeing it, witnessing it, being a part of it, being a part of a creative collaboration with another photographer. That was, to me, vital, really, really vital. So I still think that's a very, very good way to get somewhere in this industry. Not to mention a couple of those stories that I threw out there at the beginning of this conversation came directly from jobs that Annie was shooting. Now, I didn't run around trying to take any of her clients, not that I ever could have, which is Annie's greatest photographer of all time, arguably, but they were connections I made. And there was something to be said for being a reliable assistant to a very good photographer, because the clients see that and recognize that. They will have small pictures. Who are they going to call? Somebody they've met and worked with a couple of times, they've gotten to know a little bit, and then I was never in the corner schmoozing any of these people. They came to me. They wanted to know if I was available to maybe shoot something, because they knew that I had the some of the Annie lighting chops. I was doing her lighting for her, essentially, and figured, why not? So I still think that that's a very, very good inroad. I think when I look back on it, the one thing that I would have cultivated from the outset is I wish that I had found a better balance between my commercial work and maintaining a fine art presence and career. Because by the time I came back and wanted to see if I could enter the world of fine art and gallery work, it was very hard to get in. I tried to kind of get in through with the Ailey work. I did a book and I had a show, but that's its own thing that people need to cultivate for years, the same way that we cultivated our commercial successes. But there are some photographers that really maintained a beautiful equilibrium between both. Some of the photographers I admire most, Frank Auchenfels and many, many others, but Albert Watson, we talked about all the way back to Herb Ritz. I mean, Annie had trouble morphing into the fine art world. She'll sell prints, but that's something that I wish that I had kept up, because that's something now that I really, really want to transition into, is doing more personal work, more fine art work, the potential of selling prints. Because I really got into this whole thing to put something in a frame and put it on the wall and say, wow, that's pretty. That was really the whole thing, was, wow, that's pretty, that's beautiful, or that's moving, or that makes me feel this way or that way. That was the whole thing. That was the beginning. And I'd like that to, I don't want to say the ending, that sounds kind of macabre, but I would like that to be more of what it is that I'm doing. But I think it's harder to get there now, having not had my foot in that door the whole time. You know, I look at a career like Stephen Wilkes, my friend, great photographer. I don't know if you know his work. And he went from being a very commercial photographer to now being a world-renowned fine art photographer whose prints sell for tons of money, and they're beautiful, beautiful works of art. And that would be the one thing I think I'd do differently.
Interesting. And it's, I love hearing that even you still have those struggles. Not that I'm reveling in the struggle that you're having, but I love hearing that you still have those type of struggles, because I think for those of us on the outside who look at somebody who's had the type of career that you've had, you would think, oh man, they got it made in the shade. They're good to do whatever they want to do. But to hear that you still have to get out there and figure out how you're going to balance, like you said, in this instance, commercial versus the fine arts. Like, I think even Richard Avedon had those same type of struggles where he was like, I'm fashion and commercial. And, you know, then he went off and did the civil rights book with Baldwin, James Baldwin. You know, I think he struggled in that way as well. And it's interesting to hear, like I said, that even somebody of your stature and of your past and the work that you created would have to kind of find a way in to do that. But anyway, yes, I it's just interesting to me that you have those struggles and that you're still continuing to hammer it out and do what you got to do. And, you know, I think that's a great example for those of us who aspire to hit the level that you're at.
Well, thank you, Kelvin. I appreciate that. I think that this is an ongoing process. We may have fallen in love with doing it at a very, very young age, and however we got our start, we talked about mine, you've talked with many photographers about theirs, but you're going to hit speed bumps and potholes and have moments where you're burnt out or you're tired or you're exhausted or you feel slightly uninspired. But if nothing else, this COVID pause gave a lot of us an opportunity to rethink some decisions we're making. You're going to go away and give thought to what you're going to do next. I was also given an opportunity to rethink some of what I'm doing, because some of those decisions have been made for me because people that I've been working with are going in different directions. So yeah, I ain't done yet. I'm going to figure out a bunch more stuff to do. I love my assignment work, and I'll take every assignment that comes my way. I'm thrilled to be working. I'm happy to be still invited to collaborate on commercial projects. But I think this is an excellent opportunity to also start to go back to doing some of the same things that I was doing very early in my career and life, where I was setting up pictures that were for creative purposes, for just me to share with others. And we'll see where it goes.
Wise words from Andrew Echols, everyone. Andrew, man, hey, I appreciate you. And again, this has been a great conversation. I love your energy. I love your outlook, perspective, and the knowledge that you bring to the table. And, you know, hopefully in the future, our paths will cross. I know you're in the LA area and I'm out there from time to time. And I feel like I could probably have a cup of coffee with you and chat for 2-3 more hours. So.
Well, I would love that, Calvin. I've really enjoyed talking to you. You do a terrific job on this podcast, and I'm honored to be on with you. And if you do come through LA, please give me a call. And yes, we'll keep the conversation going.
All right. That was my chat with Andrew Echols. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Anytime I get the opportunity to chat with someone who has been in the game for as long as he has, it's always a treat because they're full of so much knowledge and information and great stories. So if you enjoyed the conversation and the stories that were shared today, please share this episode with someone else that you think might enjoy it. You can rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening to it now. And you can also follow us on Instagram at What Makes You Click Podcast. And for the show notes, you can go to whatmakesyouclick.com and you can check out all the resources and links that we've placed for this episode. All right, guys, until next time.